Welcome to Executive Stories, a podcast series hosted by me, Brad Vinney. Come on a journey with me as we explore not just the businesses, but the personal lives, the backstory behind remarkable directors and senior executives. Today's interview with Wayne Girard is one of those conversations when time seems to stand still and it just flies as well. Our conversation reached areas such as what was the personal decision behind Wayne's choice to start a startup like Red Eye? Why put all your assets on the line? And why did Wayne need to spend a week on the back of an outdoor motorbike going up to the Cape in order to switch off? Wayne's one of those guys. He's a CEO, he's a founder, he's gregarious, he's out there. And one thing that you can never accuse him of is not being authentic. What you see with Wayne is what you get. And that's what I loved about today's conversation. Wayne lets us into places that I've never heard of him speak of before. And I know Wayne fairly well. Wayne's the guy that got me on the startup journey in a legal sense about 5 years ago. He's the reason why I'm here doing a lot of this stuff. He's passionate, he's really influential, and he's generous with his time. And generous with his opinions as well, and generous with his honesty. He talks about some things about the not so good NPS scores, the Net Promoter Scores that they had recently. There's a lot that we cover, and I'm sure you can agree that time's gonna fly as well, and you won't know where it's gone. So strap in, this is a good one. Wayne Girard, CEO of Red Eye Apps. Wayne, welcome to Executive Stories. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Brad. It's great to be here, mate.
Wayne, the CEO of Red Eye Apps, and if you're in Brisbane or pretty much anywhere in Australia, you will have heard of them. Or if you haven't heard of them, you will have heard Wayne's voice carrying across the stage at some seminar because he's a prolific speaker and he's an uber charismatic, open kind of guy that you just can't help but sort of be drawn to the energy that he has. And I've known Wayne for quite a while now. And I think I know Wayne pretty well, but I was just saying to him, I want to get to sort of know him a little bit better. And I'm going to jump straight into, like I always do, to this time, the last conversation that I had with Wayne. And that conversation was, I was actually jumping into a bottle shop to buy a six pack.
Yep.
Wayne was about to go on holidays. And a holiday Wayne Girard style was, I'm getting on my motorbike and I'm riding to Cape York. And I'm going, okay, who jumps on a motorbike for 2 weeks, I believe it was, on a big hot piece of metal? Why don't you go sit on a beach? Like, isn't that what you're meant to do? Because you said you needed a break. I don't know where you went. I don't know how you went as well.
Yeah.
So how far did you go and how was the trip?
Thanks, Brad. So I bought a BMW 1200 GS adventure motorbike last April, and I did that because I needed to find a hobby. I'm 45. I've never had a hobby in my life. All I've really done is work, and I was getting to the point where I was completely burnt out, and I needed something I could do that I could immerse myself in and completely take my mind off work. And as you can imagine, riding I haven't really ridden motorbikes very much, and I learned to ride off-road. And then I went and did a BMW safari last year, and I got the bug for it. I love it. I took 1 week off last year, and that was my first holiday since I started Red Eye, so 5 years ago. And that riding that bike for a week just felt like a three-week holiday. Like, I literally had to disengage from work completely. I was in the bush. There was no mobile phone coverage, and it was awesome. And so I committed that I'd do that twice a year. And so this year, I was lucky enough to go on the BMW Enduro, which is a 7-day ride from Cairns to Cape York and back. And so it's 3 days up, a day at the Cape, and then 3 days back. I took 2 weeks off.
So you had company. I thought you may have gone alone. That's what I was like.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic, right? It's like glamping, right? It's basically, there was 146 motorbike riders. Mm-hmm. There was a tire crew that would change tires if you got a flat. There was a luggage truck to carry your luggage. You stayed, like, we camped every night. We camped half the nights and we stayed in hotels half the night. And when I say hotels, we're talking like the pub at Cowan, which is, you know, dodgy as hell. But it was fantastic. It was great fun. And the people that go on these rides are just genuine people, really, really nice. Most of them are, you know, I think the average age is 54. And people are, you know, they're pretty much mostly successful people who are either retiring or, you know, have the means to take time off. They've invested in a decent motorbike and they're going really to just have an experience and to hang out with really great people.
So how long's a day in the saddle?
It's 7 or 8 hours of riding. So it's a huge day. These bikes are big, right? My bike's 260 kilos. It's very heavy to pick up. And, you know, you're standing up on the foot pegs while you ride. You're riding on the
dirt. It's no Kawasaki kind of thing that Mick Doohan rides.
No, this is three times heavier than that.
Okay.
Of course, we're only ever doing the speed limit. Mm. You're riding on the dirt road up to the Cape, doing about 120 Ks. In the dirt, there's 140 guys on the road, there's dust everywhere, it's hard to see. We were lucky enough to go and do the old Telegraph track, which is an unbelievable four-wheel drive track. Some really great deep river crossings, just, you know, experiences that are really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I loved it, absolutely love it.
So what do you think about when you're 7 hours in the saddle every day, dust in your eyes? Do you think about anything, or do you find that your mind wanders and goes into that beautiful place? Like, what's it like?
It's a really amazing experience. You go through, I go through stages. Like, the first day or 2 days, I'm unwinding from work. And so I'm also getting comfortable again with the bike. And I'm really concentrating on learning, you know, making sure that I can corner well, that I don't run off the road, that I don't stack. That, you know, I can handle the sand or the bull dust or whatever I'm going through. And so you're very engaged. And then, you know, day 3, 4, 5, you start to get into the zone and you feel confident and you start to kind of express yourself or challenge yourself, which is great. And then, you know, day 5, 6, 7, I'm thinking about work, like to a degree, like, but not in the business, more on the business. So I'm starting to get a clear head and I'm starting to see opportunities and, you know, and the challenges that I want to solve. So it's very therapeutic, really.
I was going to say, I think I may have mentioned this to you when we spoke last, was it sounded a lot like meditation or yoga in a way, where they talk about being present in the moment.
Yeah.
And the way that you can do that is to focus on your breath, and it's just something to focus on. And therefore, you are paying attention to where you are right now. Forget about everything else. And it sounds a lot like kind of like a rev heads version of yoga almost.
It's, you know, the number of times that I broke out in a spontaneous smile while I was riding, it's hard to believe. Like, I'd literally be riding along and my face would just light up in a smile and I would just feel awesome. I'm like, I am so grateful to have this opportunity. Yeah, it's definitely a form of meditation for me.
Hmm. So towards the end of the trip, you're starting to think a little bit more about the business or on the business. Is it light bulb moment kinds of things, or is it just really high level sort of thoughts that you have? What sort of things come to you?
Yeah, for me, they're very much, it's big picture kind of thinking where I find that things gel, or I find that I'm able to, basically see the patterns and the kind of data that's happening in the business, and it gives me a sense of the areas that are working really well that I'm comfortable with, or the opportunities that I have, or, you know, it also gives me that moment of time where I can sit there and go, hey, you know, I really need to work on this, I need to address this. And sometimes it's me working on me, Wayne, the person, the CEO, the founder, the leader. And sometimes it's like working on a functional area, or, yeah, for example, we've opened in North America, as you know, and it's like, okay, what have I got to do to propel North America?
Because I find that because I'm a yoga person, that when I walk out of a great yoga class where my mind has really relaxed, it's like defragging, like a computer defrags and you just take away all the clutter.
Yeah.
And you just feel a lot lighter in the head. And do you think that sometimes in that instance, your ability to take such a high-level view and comprehend data and patterns was helped by the previous 5 days that you had, and you wouldn't necessarily have been able to get there if you hadn't have done the riding, for example?
I'm a huge believer in the need to get out of get out of the business, right? And free yourself up and give yourself that opportunity to, assess the situation in a constructive and unconstrained way. And I think, writing is my yoga.
Mm. Do you think you will hold yourself to that one week, twice a year thing now? Because you don't have a great track record of living that ethos that you just described. But because there is a benefit, you know, and you can really see the value. Will you? When's the next one?
Yeah, definitely. I was hopeless at taking time off, and for the last 5 years running, founding and growing Red Eye, I'd like take time off over Christmas, and I'd religiously work the whole time. And so finding off-road motorbike riding is definitely something I'll stick to. I emailed the guys today to find out the dates for next year. I'm locking myself in for two trips next year, definitely. I went, I've just been to the US, got back on the weekend, and went out Sunday all day on the bike up in the bush with a couple of mates.
Nice.
Just fantastic. I've got Instagram, and I'm literally deleting people off Instagram who are like business colleagues. I just want my Instagram feed to be just motorbikes.
So do you think that things like Instagram can be used effectively for business, or do they start encroaching into your life? Because for executive stories, I'm setting up an Instagram account, and I've started populating it with sort of corporate-y kind of things, but also getting a feel for who I am as a person and what I'm doing. Would that be the kind of thing that you'd go, you know what, nah, I'm really just interested in motorbikes?
Yeah, so I've made a choice. LinkedIn and Facebook are very much work related. So I have a personal profile on Facebook, but I really, really only post things that are work related, right? Mm. And I share and like things that are work related. And when I say work related, I mean things that are related to Red Eye, but also related to my passion around building the ecosystem. So it's a good medium for me to encourage a conversation around the ecosystem. Mm. And LinkedIn is very much around those two as well. And so I've then chosen that Instagram is going to be my personal thing, and I'm not doing anything work-related on there at all.
So the Facebook one I find actually really interesting, because Red Eye's target clients are really enterprise-level clients, big asset owners. I wouldn't have thought that they would necessarily be on Facebook necessarily, so you don't building a profile, but are they?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, they're people, right?
Mm.
Yeah, some of my best mates are senior executives in our clients' organisations. And we don't necessarily communicate about work all the time. Like, I've got a mate on Facebook who's a really senior client, and he's doing up an awesome old hole and new, right? And just staying in touch with what he's doing and him staying in touch with what I'm doing. Yeah, we've been able to hook up in different cities around the world just because we're there at the same time, right? We found out through Facebook. Yeah. And so, yeah, for me, I think Facebook is... Facebook's almost a universal platform now. We sell to senior people in enterprise companies, but we have lots of users who are at all different levels.
That's a really good point, hey? Yeah. Because I've been a bit reluctant to use Facebook as a business tool, because I feel as though Facebook is my personal outlet, and I don't really have anything on there that I'd be that worried about, apart from the fact that I've never changed my profile pic since 2006.
Did you have more hair then?
I have a lot more hair, actually. I've been a bit reluctant to do that, but I think we do forget that we're all people.
Yeah.
The business is the business, but people aren't Simon Sinek says or someone, people by people at the end of the day. And it's something to take away from that, for me, at least.
Like I have a saying, right? People buy from people they like and trust.
Yeah.
Yeah? You've got to like someone to invest the time and energy it takes to trust someone.
Mm.
And I don't know about you, but life's too short to be in business with dickheads.
Mm.
And so I don't want clients that are dickheads. I don't want to be a dickhead. I don't want anyone on my team that's a dickhead. And so I think it's very hard to blur the line. It's very hard to have a separate work and life. Yeah. I think in today's environment, work and life is one thing. Right. And so this concept of work-life balance is about getting comfortable being authentic or being genuine and just letting people know that you're real. And yeah, they can. I'm happy for my clients to see every side of me. Right.
That's a really nice sort of way to frame that work-life balance, because just to go be your authentic self at work and away from work.
Absolutely.
You know, don't just sort of put on a particular mask for an occasion. Sure, adapt to your surroundings, but you know, you can still be yourself. And if you went out and had a good time on a Friday night, you know, we're probably at the stage where our Friday nights going out are a lot more tame than what they were when my 2006 profile went up. So dig a bit further. Yeah, that resonates a lot with me as well. And who I the whole purpose of this whole podcast series, in a way, is just sort of trying to connect with people one to one and go, hey, Wayne's the CEO of a massive scale up now. But yeah, he gets his downtime by getting on motorbikes and getting dusty. And, you know, he likes Facebook as well.
Yeah.
You know? getting back to your motorcycle trip, at the end of it. So you got back, had the fort at Red Eye fallen over without the leader in charge there?
No, far from it, right? This year is a really exciting year for us at Red Eye. We're moving, you know, the business as it's scaling, we're moving from me as the CEO and really being responsible for most of the functional areas to putting in place an executive leadership team. And so we've got some great people and they're all learning and growing and developing just like I am. And me being away from the business actually gives them the space to express themselves, the space to not be conscious around me. Mm. And I think that's a great thing. It's helpful as well because I end up in the US a lot. And so there are these blocks of time, like every month or 2 months, where the team is without me for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And that's been really helpful in letting people find their feet, find their groove, and you know, the business to become accustomed to different people setting the direction and setting the expectations and holding people accountable. So that's cool.
And is that across the board, or are you sort of executive management? Is that like your dev team? Is it your ops team, your sales team? Who's stepping up while you're away?
Yeah, so we've got a COO. His name's Mike, and he's responsible for our project delivery and our customer success team. And at the moment, he's also responsible for development and product. We're recruiting a CTO at the moment, and he'll take over development and product. We have a chief commercial officer, a CCO. He's responsible for our sales team. We've just recruited a design lead. So one of my kind of visions for the business is to become truly design led. And so recruiting a design lead was a huge step.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that we design and build functionality with our clients, not for our clients.
Mm-hmm.
And so that what we're doing is we're optimizing the way we invest our time and resources to deliver things that really make a difference. So we have a brand promise, right? Our brand promise is easy plus fast plus relevant plus secure equals essential.
Mm.
And the only way you can get there is if you do that with your clients. You can't guess what your clients want. Yeah, well, you could try, but it's gonna cost you money and waste time. And I'd rather just cut to the chase and involve them in the process and make them feel valued as part of it, right?
Matthew Horton from FoundU was saying that they have a similar kind of philosophy, and he goes, are my clients talk to my dev team directly.
Yeah.
And the customers love that we're tailoring every solution almost to their business, because he said they've come to the realization that they need to be pliable and understand that all their customers are different. And whilst they would love to have something that would be easily drop-down menu customizable, it actually requires spending time with them. Okay.
Like I'm a huge believer that our customers, they'll buy from us and they'll value our services if we show them that we understand their problems and that we value their input.
No brainer.
Yeah, it is, really.
Yeah. Well, it's glad to hear see that the Ford didn't fall down. I'm just going to rewind a little bit because I genuinely don't know the answer to this question. Okay, so I know that Wayne Girard is passionate about startups. He's passionate about changing the way that the economy works and is shaped. And when you and Randall saw a problem around the management of engineering drawings, you felt like it needed to be solved. It's that bit there that I really want to understand, because who in their right mind would turn their back on a decent job, regular income, not mortgaging your assets up to the hilt and having the pressure of starting a startup. Because whilst I get all that kind of sexy stuff, there's a lot of crazy stuff in there as well. Like, how did you manage to tip the pendulum and go, you know what, yeah, we're going to do it?
So a couple of things. There was no startup community. There was no sex and sizzle and excitement around being an entrepreneur when we started Red Eye, right? We just solved a problem. So today, you know, there's this hype around being an entrepreneur or being a startup founder. That certainly wasn't the case for us when we started. What really happened was I had a consulting company, and yeah, it was doing pretty well. We, you know, turned over about $1 million a year, and you know, I was living quite comfortably, but I was traveling a lot and I was really the product.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not scalable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also not saleable or sustainable, right?
Mm-hmm.
We built a really, really nice house right below Wivenhoe Dam, moved in 5 months before the dam flooded in January 2011.
Great timing,
right? And yeah, timing's something that you'll hear through my stories. I've made some faux pas, right?
Mm.
And so, you know, we got flooded. We had to rip out everything up to 900 mils high. So we ripped out all the walls, all the kitchens, all the floor.
How new was the house? I lived for five months
old, right? Yeah, it cost about $365,000 to fix it. We still don't have floor coverings to today, right? So for the last 6-7 years, whatever it's been, we've lived in a house with concrete floors.
Holy.
Yeah, we last, this Christmas just gone was the first, we bought our first bit of new furniture to replace since the floods, right? We bought a lounge. Other than that, we've been living on lounges that got flooded. And the ones that got destroyed, we threw away, and we got donated this old lounge that we lived on for the last 5 years, right? So we kind of started Red Eye after that experience. And for me, it was very much Andy and I sitting down. So we were literally sitting down at New Year's Eve, end of 2010, beginning of 2011, going, we just moved into our dream house. My consulting business is going really well. You know, life's pretty damn good. And then 11 days later, it gets turned on its head.
Mm.
Andy and I then sit down after living on someone's veranda for a week, watching our son have his birthday, you know, living in someone else's house, having lost most of our possessions.
Yeah, and what you haven't lost is covered in mud and waterlogged.
Exactly right. And we had to pull it all out ourselves. Luckily, we had some people around that would help, which was really nice. But we sat down and we basically said, we've got to change the way we operate, right? So me being the product at work isn't scalable. It's not sustainable. If something happens, Andy and the family are, you know, screwed. So I then kind of committed to building a business that was scalable and sustainable without me. And I kind of had the consulting company that I had to keep working in and keep forward commitments and everything. So I said, right, I'm going to keep delivering what I've got. But while I'm doing that, I'm going to look around and try and identify a problem I can solve and set up a new business to do it. And so that was really the catalyst for me to open my mind to start a new company.
Yeah, and talking about that consultation with Andy, and were your boys involved in that conversation? Were they a bit young back then? They would have been like 11 or something.
Yeah, they were pretty young.
Yeah. So like, what does that conversation look like from her perspective, do you think? Was she like, yeah, you're right, you know, and do you sort of throw into the mix there, hey, we're going to have even more financial stress potentially. I'm going to probably be working for very little money and I'm going to be away a lot, whether it's just locked in a room or not. And does she sort of go, yeah, I get it and that's okay? Or was it like, I don't know, how does that conversation unfold?
You know, we didn't really think about how we were going to execute. All we thought about was what we have now is not sustainable,
mm-hmm.
right? We need to do something different. And it was really her, like it was Andy that raised it, right? She's like, you know, you travel all the time. I was traveling like 170 days a year with a consulting company.
Mm.
It was intense. And so for me to change, I needed to build a business where it wasn't so dependent on Wayne. Mm. And that was kind of the catalyst. And so we just agreed that would be the case. I was a member of EO, the Entrepreneurs Organization at that time. And there was an opportunity to go to an EO conference called an EO University in Houston in April.
Mm-hmm.
And so four of my mates at EO and I said, well, we're going to go over. Let's hire a bus. Let's go a week or two early because, you know, jet lag, right? Let's go and visit some other EO chapters, which are EO groups,
mm-hmm.
and learn from them, like, who's doing what in business, and see, just let's get a sense of how business is done in the US.
And is it a coincidence, though, that your very first foray into the US market was in Houston? Was it in Houston?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, is that a coincidence? Or?
Yeah, complete coincidence, really, right?
Okay. Like the, I was just seeing whether there was like early sort of seed planted there.
No, I don't think so. I think it was just oil and gas was in Houston in 2014 when we opened there first time.
Yeah.
And yeah.
That's really interesting because Mark Salvey talks about how when they started Blue Sky, he and his wife, they sat down and it was a conscious decision that they would have to sell a lot of stuff, put it all into the business. He worked crazy hours commuting from the Gold Coast. She moved down there with the family, or they moved down there so that they had family support and the like. And because these decisions, they are team decisions a lot of the time. And I think people sort of forget that. You know, we see the Wayne Girard in the papers and on stage, as I said, sort of, you know, get everyone to stand up and shake hands with the person. But there's someone that's actually, there's another part of the equation that's there supporting it and saying, yes, this is my journey as well, because you still travel a fair bit and
heaps, right? And I couldn't have done it without Andy. She's just magnificent, quite frankly. Like, she's been the glue of our family.
Yeah.
And you know, the kids have grown up.
How old are they? Are they like 17, 16 and 18 or?
No, Clay's 19 and Zach's just turned 18.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So Clay's been working in the business a bit, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's part time in the business, and believe it or not, Zach just started full time 2 months ago.
What's Zach doing?
Zach's a project coordinator, and Clay's doing sales.
And what's it like having the family around more often?
I love it. Yeah. I love it, right? Like, I'm a huge believer in giving kids a chance or their first job. Mm. And it's not just my kids. In fact, we've recruited, it'd be 15 or 16 people straight out of university and given them their first jobs. And so part of who I am as a person is about creating jobs here in Brisbane, here in Queensland. And I think if you can give a young person that's hungry an opportunity, and you can show them that they're way more capable than they realised, it's a great thing.
Just sort of going back to the early days of Red Eye again, there's a thing that we like to say in startup sort of speak around fail and fail fast. And there's like this badge of honour that you get if you've failed. It sounds kind of glamorous, but I struggle with it a little bit because someone lost money along the way and someone had to pick up the tab. But when you started, was failure an option?
Brad, today failure is still not an option, right? I don't believe in that saying, fail fast. I think it is the glorified no responsibility, just have a crack kind of startup talk. The reality is, you're right, like, in our case, our entire life is tied up in this business. If the business fails, we lose our house. And I have a responsibility and accountability to my family to provide them with a return on investment for the 5.5 years of hard work that they've put in supporting me to get here, right? Mm. And it's exactly the same if you take investor money. So failure has never been an option for us. I think failure is I think there's enough education in the market today. There's enough opportunities in the startup community to learn from other people's mistakes. There's enough of a support environment around you that you should be able to, if you're conscious enough, be able to pick a decent problem and then surround yourself with people that can help you solve that problem and commercialize that problem.
Yeah, because I don't mind the saying fail fast. If, say, you're young and you just want to have a crack at something, you go, don't spend a lot of money so someone's not really picking up the tab. And, you know, you have a learning experience around what it's like to get a business up off the ground kind of thing. But, yeah, I think it needs to be put in the context of responsible sort of financial management at the same time, or calculated financial sort of responsibility at the end of the day with your investors. And that's why they call them friends, family and fools at the end of the day. And probably they're all fools in some respect if they don't make calculated decisions about who they're backing. And I think that the startup community needs to make sure that they are putting their best foot forward when trying to pitch for investor money.
I have a kind of saying, right? Like, someone asked me once, they said, so, how do you know you're working on the right idea? And I went, yeah, it's a good question. And so I went away and I kind of sat down and tried to work it out, and I looked at Red Eye as an example, and I went, okay, well, what are the characteristics? And I think there are three things. I think we were lucky, right? We stumbled onto a problem that was really big and really expensive for our clients. And so I think finding a problem that's really large and really expensive is like the first step. The second step is then, finding a problem that is relevant in lots of geographies and lots of markets. Because, you know, if you're stuck in one industry and the industry is cyclical, you're in trouble, right? If you're stuck in one geography and what you have won't scale outside that geography, then you're in trouble, yeah? So I think you need to find something that is really, really is scalable. And then the third thing, and I think we lucked onto this as well, right, is that choose a problem that is not someone else's core business. Mm-hmm. Because if it's someone else's, like if we chose a problem that was, say, the core business of SAP,
I've had that in my mind, SAP, because they seem to have its core business just about everything.
Well, exactly right. The reality is they do a lot of things, but they only do a couple of things really, really well. And they'll protect those things that they do really, really well with 80 to 90% of their investment base, yeah? And then they'll spend the other 10% on all their ancillary stuff. And so we just happen to solve a problem that's ancillary to a lot of people, but not their core business. And we've made it our core business, and we're super passionate about it, and we know it inside out. And so we've been able to get traction, even competing against multi-billion dollar companies, because we do this one thing and we do it so well, right? And so for me, I think any founder that's looking at a problem or wants to start a startup, they should ask themselves three questions. Is what I'm doing is it a really big problem for my clients, and is it expensive for them? Is what I'm proposing relevant in lots of geographies and lots of industries? And is what I'm proposing hopefully not the core business of some really large company that can just squash me? Right? And if you can get through those three things, I think you've got you've probably got a good opportunity that you could invest energy in.
And as you say, a good dose of luck helps along the way as well.
It's amazing how important luck is. Mm.
I know the harder you work, the luckier you get. We all both know that luck just seems to stumble upon you sometimes, and you're grateful for the opportunity or for the serendipitous nature of what's just happened to you.
I think luck, karma, market cycles, they all play a part.
Mm.
I think the more you give, like the more generous you are with your knowledge, your experience, your time, the more the universe karma comes back to you and creates opportunities for you.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I think you need to build up a bank first. You can't go into negative, because I started on this startup journey. It was with you, because I had no idea what a startup was about 5 years ago, let alone this ecosystem, because you say it didn't really exist. But I came along for that journey and I got interested, and I've been in there for a critical mass of time now, helping people. And I actually get all sorts of law firms, accountants coming up to me and saying, how do we get into this startup scene? And I just say to them, you can't get into it. I said, you need to willingly attend. You need to willingly give of yourself with no agenda. And that's a tough thing to do, because our sort of financial metrics on performance, they don't necessarily have a little box that we tick there for that kind of thing. But I've noticed that after having done it for a long time now, that I find giving more easy, because it is coming back. And when you see it, seeing is believing at the end of the day. Like, I wouldn't do it for 10 years and see no return, because that's a hobby then at the end of the day. And that's okay if that's all it is. But it's nice to see that when you pay it forward, it does come back, and you just continue to fill the funnel of paying it forward and trying to keep your bank topped up to make sure that you stand the best possible opportunity to get some back.
I think we were lucky here, right? Because when the startup ecosystem was embryonic and there was a small group of people, and you were there, right, starting to contribute to building momentum, we all agreed up front that we would build a startup community that had this kind of underpinning culture of give before you get. And so we all started talking about give before you get, give before you get, give before you get. And that's really been, I think, a mantra in the community. And now everyone that comes into the startup community here in Queensland understands that's like the ticket to the game. And it's a super nice place to be. And I actually think the benefit is that we'll produce more startups. They'll have better success. They'll have better success faster. There'll be more opportunities for Queenslanders to get new jobs. And we'll be solving really good problems, right? And I think overall, that'll accelerate our startup ecosystem. And in fact, it is. You can see in the latest data, you know, we're now a bigger startup community than Victoria. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's fantastic. How's Redeye paying it forward with its enterprise customers to sort of like get it back from them? Are you sort of like, do you work with them for a long time, the long lead times and throwing solutions at them? Does that sort of come into play at all?
Yeah, so like a month ago or 6 weeks ago, we ran an executive forum and we invited all of our key clients, and we invited two or three people from every client organization to come into Brisbane, and we ran a session for a day, 5 panel sessions, and it was all about things that are important to them. So what's digital transformation? What's BIM and where do you want to go with it? How are you adopting mobility? What do you want from mobility? What's big data? And where do you see your businesses in 3 to 5 years? And they were just panels of people from our clients' organizations talking. Redeye only moderated. We didn't do anything other than that. And so the whole idea was a knowledge sharing activity between clients. And the benefit for us was that we got insight into the things that are important to them, so we can put them into our product roadmaps, so we can build products that actually solve their problems. Okay?
And you get to know your customers better. This whole thing about spending time together and FaceTime and Facebook and whatever it is, there's all these different touch points. And I guess that's another one to show that you care.
Heaps, right?
You know, like it's not the obvious one, like, tell me about your business. You're just sitting there listening about the conversations that they have, and it's a really nice way just to be a sponge, I guess.
It was fantastic. Like, they came in the night before. We went to a restaurant and had, like, a big family-style dinner. So we had one long table. We had, like, 45 or 46 people around this long table, all the food in the middle of the table, and we just had a conversation, and people moved, like, we literally moved people around during courses, and it's just this, like, it feels like Redeye... and our clients, we're one big family, and we consciously cultivate that environment, right? Because we want them to know we care. Like, it's not just about selling shit. It's about helping them get where they want to go and about doing it in a way where we all enjoy the experience.
And what was the feedback from everyone that attended? Did you get some, was it all good?
Yeah, but like,
that's what I'm trying to get. Yeah, cutting away all the crap.
Yeah, it was really positive. Yeah. Like, one of our clients, so Snowy Hydro, is recording a video for us now. They openly say in the video that we're the best supplier they've ever had. Right. That's
a pretty good thing to have. A big thing for a big corporate, partially state-owned, I think, or biggest shareholders that are state-owned.
State and federal
governments, and just sort of this whole thing about engaging with startups, because I think startups can, and scale-ups can offer something which is more personable and more genuine than necessarily the SAPs of the world.
Absolutely. Like, our clients, like, we just did an NPS, so a Net Promoter Score survey.
How'd you go?
It sucked, right? Like, we sucked because we only had 60 people respond out of 1,000, right? So the sample set's not
big. It's kind of an all or nothing kind of score as well. You're either kicking ass or you're stuffed.
And, like, we had some really good comments in there.
Yeah.
Like, I'm trying to remember now. One of the clients said, we love the fact that you're so responsive, right? If we've got a problem, you just literally, you're turning it around straight away, right? And so that was really nice feedback. Yeah, we had some negative feedback as well, right? Like, the person that was meant to train me wasn't there because they were sick, so I don't know how to use the system, right? And stuff like that. People get confused about the quality of their data versus the quality of the system, and then go and then blame the system.
Yeah.
And so there's stuff like that we've got to fix. And so we set up a customer success team to literally create successful customers.
Isn't that really interesting though? Because both of those things are really minor, yet it caused them to give you a low score.
Yeah.
Because you would think if you know what the NPS is actually about, you should be going, give me a high score, but just give me that sort of, hey, you could have done this bit better. But it actually really meant something to that person. So you looking after the detail is actually really, really important, because it might seem like, hey, we're looking after, $1 billion worth of assets here with this solution. yet here you're focusing on the fact that someone didn't turn up on the training day, but you're only as strong as your weakest link at the end of the day. And it's really important, I guess.
It's hugely important. And me personally, I care a lot, right? Like, I don't want a customer to be upset, right? Even though we're scaling and, you know, a scale up, I still believe in handcrafted solutions. So, my response is get our customer success team out and train the person, right? And we'll also, introduce a technology solution that gives them better online help and all that kind of stuff. But the immediate response is, let's invest specific people's time and energy to fix the problem.
And thanks for sharing those negative things, because I guess they're the things which you don't necessarily, especially when you know you're being recorded. But it's reality, and it's how you respond to those things at the end of the day that I think are the true measure of how great an organisation you are, not whether you get negative feedback.
No, exactly right. Like, there's no perfect organisation, there's no perfect product, there's no perfect customer experience. We all know that new customers come on, especially with enterprise solutions, they come on and they go through a period of disillusionment at the beginning, right? The data's not as great as it could be. They're still learning how to use the system. There's a whole bunch of complexity around the transition, the change management, a bit of friction. And so you really need to, that's just life. And you can't shy away from that. You can't say it doesn't happen. That's ridiculous, right? What you're going to do is own it and work out how to, constantly be improving the experience.
And that's what, because that's part of you. Everyone knows that people aren't perfect.
Yeah.
It's people when they pretend as though they are, and that's when you don't like them at the end of the day.
Yeah, one of the things at Red Eye is we hire people who are developing, not developed, right? And we do that for two reasons. We do that, firstly, because when we started here, the ecosystem, there was no proven performers that had grown enterprise SaaS companies, right? And even today, very few and far between, right? So we've had to hire people and help them learn how to be awesome in their role. And that's been great, because we've been able to hire people who are really passionate, not people who've got a lot of baggage. And so I really like that. The downside of it is that I've got to constantly remind the team that everyone's learning and growing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're learning and growing, me included, right, you make mistakes. Mm. And those mistakes have an unintended consequence on other people in the team. And if the other person in the team gets frustrated or annoyed because of the mistake, which they often do, right, that creates a negative ripple effect, right? And so it can impact your culture. We care, I care so much about culture. I want to build a great culture. So I'm always trying to remind people, hey, remember they're learning, give them a little bit of breathing room, right? And it's the same with our clients. Like, the better the relationship we have with our clients, the better, the more breathing room they give us when we make mistakes.
And do you have a bit of a philosophy? I think I saw one of your leadership things where you encourage people, it's a very strong mention, to own your mistakes as well, and don't sort of try and think that someone else will fix it. Own it, fix it, make it yours, and then move on, kind of thing.
Big time, right? So our culture has a number of attributes. One of those, personal responsibility. And that is very much, I want people to own things, and I want them to own the good side and the bad side of that.
Mm.
I think it's great that you can give a young person or a new person into the industry ownership of something, and they can feel proud, and they can feel like they've got a sense of achievement, and they can feel like they're making a difference, like their thing matters.
Mm-hmm.
And the negative side of that is they've also got to step up and go, hey, actually, what I just did didn't work, right? And so we do stacks and stacks of lessons learned. And that's really my vehicle, not to punish people for doing things wrong. It's just to get everyone comfortable that to get it out on the table. I don't care if it's bad. I just care about what we're going to do next to improve it.
It's a great philosophy to have. And I guess that's why I hope to think I don't make too many mistakes when I'm doing the legal work. But it's not knowing that you've kind of got someone, a client that's got your back as well, is a really nice thing as a service provider as well. So, yeah. I'm going to throw a couple of rapid-fire questions at you. Okay, really quick answers. What keeps Wayne awake at night?
Making sure that we have enough money in the bank, making sure that our sales are growing, making sure my family's happy, and making sure my team are, the culture's really great.
How do you personally stay ahead of the game?
How do I do it? I take time out to recharge myself. So I listen to a fair few podcasts. The moment I'm listening to Reid Hoffman's podcast, Masters of Growth, that's excellent.
Mm-hmm.
The Andreessen Horowitz A16Z podcast. One of the things that I need as a founder and a CEO, I'm in the uncharted waters, right? And so there's no example of how this has been done before. And what I need is, I need the confidence. I need those confidence boosters that remind me that it's okay to not be perfect, that it's okay to make mistakes, that it's okay to take longer than you thought. And I get that by listening to those podcasts and hearing the real life stories of these really big tech companies that have scaled.
I love podcasts like that. Like, yeah. I was listening to one this morning. It's quite funny. Tony Robbins and Gary Vee.
Yeah, yeah.
And holy hell, you want like testosterone on a podcast. Like you got two alpha guys. And the energy was too much for me because, you know, both of them just need to dominate. And they're dominating each other. But I still like listening to it because I see how they even just relate to each other and how like maybe my personality could be overbearing. So there's so much to be gained just by listening to podcasts. And I see them as being a big thing in the sort of the short to medium term until something potentially bigger comes along, for us all to be able to sit down and listen. Like we've been going here for now 45 minutes and I told you that it would only be sort of like 30 and
wow.
Time just goes. And I think when you have a great story, people get engaged in it. Like I'm trying to keep an eye on the time and it's slipping away from me.
Do you know, one of the lessons I learned early on is that you can get content from lots and lots of sources. And what I had to teach myself to do, so I went to lots of seminars, lots of Tony Robbins events and lots of other things, you know, over the last 15 years. And sometimes you get into a conference or a seminar and the presenter's a dick, excuse my language, right? Mm. But their message is really important.
Mm.
And so, you know, teaching myself to ignore the messenger and look for the you know, the nugget, right? And so I'm always consciously trying to go, okay, I might not like their language style, or I might not like their accent, or I might not like their demeanor. What can I take away from their message?
Mm. Yeah, I find that I'm a really newcomer to Tony Robbins, and I think I'm in that camp as well. He's so brash and so bold, and I'm like, what are your qualifications to be doing any of this? But there are some serious nuggets of goodness in what he says. And he articulates it very clearly.
Yep.
And yeah, it's up to you. And the number of people that I have met that who I admire has been really normal people that go, yeah, I went to a Tony Robbins event when I was young and it stayed with me. Justin Dry from Vino Mofo.
Yep.
He's saying the same thing. Like, yeah, I went to an event when I was actually had a really down part in my life. I thought back to some of the messages that came out of that and I picked myself up and I'm like, wow, like people are picking up these nuggets. And it's an important thing to do in life is not to put the blinkers up and be open to good messages.
Yeah, I think, you know, don't shoot the messenger. Mm. Look for the gold in the content.
Well, I hope that's maybe when people see that from me as well. My wife should at least.
I love it, Brad. Yeah,
on that note, I'm going to wrap it up. Thank you for coming along and fantastic chat.
Yeah, mate, I really appreciate it. And I think this is a great podcast. Take care, Brad.
Cheers.
Well, that didn't disappoint. As promised, there's so much passion, so much energy in Wayne. It's just compelling listening. Thank you, Wayne, for not just your generosity on executivestories.com, but also everything you give to the startup community and everyone that's around it. If anyone wants to get in contact with me, please reach out to me on LinkedIn, Twitter, the Clark Kent website, or Executive Stories, www.executivestories.com. See you next time.